All right, you guys ready? Hey, who was in my session just a few minutes ago? Hey, thanks for staying. All right. So I get to do this all over again with a different topic. So, hey, all right. Yeah, big fan in the back. Thank you. Rock and roll. All right. Okay, on that note, all right. So this topic is deep dive on managing content types at scale. So enterprise content types. So enterprise content types is a misnomer. There is no such thing as enterprise content types. So the first thing is the title is a bunch of garbage. And in terms of deep dive, this is probably more like halfway in between the shallow end and the deep side of the pool. We're sort of doing the almost deep dive. We're not going to go into the internals and dig up databases and show you source code. Well, maybe a little source code, but not much. But we're going to go reasonably deep. We're not going to go crazy deep. We want to make it more practical and make sure you understand the pitfalls. So with me is Chris Bortlick. Chris is a technology specialist in the Northeast region on SharePoint. He's been doing SharePoint for as long as I can remember. Chris, actually, the funny thing is I used to work at Microsoft, and Chris was my customer. I recruited Chris into Microsoft and then left Microsoft to start Jornada. So it's a small world. You know, it's all one happy family. So Chris is actually super deep on SharePoint, knows a lot of great things, and helped me actually work on SharePoint 2010, the essential SharePoint 2010. We're going to give another copy of that book away in the session as well. And we're working on, Chris and I are working together with Sue Hanley, who I think left, but we're working on the 2013 book. And this is, by the way, the third version of the cover that Chris prefers. So we'll never actually agree on a cover at this point. And if you weren't in my last session, so I'm the chief architect and CEO at a company called Jornada. We're at, you know, we were in the booth, and if you went to the party last night, we helped sponsor that. But I'm what's called a certified architect and an MVP, which I think Jared mentioned in the opening day session. So I've been doing SharePoint for about 13 years now, and I love it and hate it. You know, it's one of those things. So what are we going to talk about in this session? All right, so unfortunately, Bob is not making an appearance in this session if you're a fan of Bob. So I know some people are afraid of missing Bob, but, you know, what we're going to talk about, because we're going right to the meat of the content. So we're going to talk about four key things, right? We're going to talk about what is your strategy around enterprise content types, again, using that term or concept. The second one is working with site columns under the covers. How do site columns actually work? And there's probably things you don't even realize are happening under the covers when you use site columns. Same things with content types, right, which are closely related to site columns in that you need to use site columns to create your metadata, and then you have other attributes in a content type like workflow, et cetera. And then finally, I'm going to talk through an actual customer scenario, which is a client of mine, and talk through what some of their challenges were with using content types across site collections, which is really what we're talking about here, and how they addressed those challenges. All right, so let's talk about your enterprise content type strategy. So first off, what is a content type, right? Let's start small and then work our way up. So a content type is essentially a definition of a common set of things like doc templates, site columns for metadata, workflows, information management policies, right, that you can apply to one or more document libraries within a site collection. Okay, why would you do this? Again, the idea is that if I have a contract and I want certain pieces of metadata information on a contract, I might define a content type called contract, which actually allows me to keep those consistent across all the libraries in my site collection. So I'll define my content type at the site collection level. Various document libraries can make use of that content type. And then any user who uses or manipulates or manages or whatever a contract, the same behavior will happen or apply to all contracts across all libraries. Where we run into trouble, though, is that because content types are defined at the site collection level, we actually can't use content types across site collections unless we use what's called the content type hub, which we'll talk about in a minute. All right, so what are some examples of content types, right? You have things like proposals, you have things like contracts, invoices, videos, anything could be a content type, right? And once I define those in my organization, then I can make use of them. And the reason you want to do that is in an enterprise content management scenario, oftentimes you want to lock down and have a rigid process around what it means to manage a contract within your organization, for example. So let's take proposal as an example, right? I might have four custom columns like, you know, what client it is, how much is the amount of the proposal, what's the due date, et cetera. And I might need those because, number one, it makes my content easier to find later. Number two, I might have specific workflow processes which depend on those metadata columns. And then actually going to, you know, things like records management, I might actually have my disposition policy either based on the content type or a combination of the content type and some other information. I also might want to have a template, a workflow, my retention that I just mentioned, et cetera. Why would you actually use content types? Really, at the end of the day, you just want consistency. Again, ECM, the whole point of ECM is not just working with documents, et cetera, but getting to the point where actually managing them in a consistent way. And content types actually help you do that from both an attributes perspective and a behavior perspective, right? Attributes meaning, what is the template I'm using? Like, is it a Word template? Is it an Excel template? Is it a PowerPoint template? What are the properties I'm collecting, et cetera? And then a behavior perspective is, what workflows are applied? What approval processes are applied? What retention schedules are applied, right? So you want that consistency across both attributes and behavior. So let's talk about three key elements of your enterprise content type strategy. So number one is planning. I'm a big fan of planning because, you know, there's this whole adage, right? If you don't plan, wait, if you, I don't know, something. Failing to plan is planning to fail, right? That's what it is. Just want to make sure you guys are paying attention. Nobody actually shouted it out. But so what do you do in the planning stage? Well, you want to identify core metadata values for filtering and searching, right? From a business perspective, what do you really need to capture? I've actually seen a lot of customers, unfortunately, they're either on one end of the spectrum or the other, right? They're either doing nothing in regard to making sure they have consistency. And then all of a sudden they go, we need consistency. And they go whole hog and create 57 content types. And the users are just like, I don't know what's going on. I hate my life. Please kill me now. Right? So what we want to do is we want to find that happy medium of when do you really need to use content types? Because you don't always need to use them as often as you think you do. You want to identify retention and disposition policies, right? Pretty makes sense. You want to define, you know, foundational elements for other content information, just, you know, things that we mentioned before. And then you want to figure out, do I really need content types? Because again, they're a great feature of SharePoint, but like anything, and especially anything in SharePoint, if they're used incorrectly, then they actually can do more harm than good in terms of user adoption and usability, right? You also want to figure out, do we need content types or universal metadata values or whatever it is, do we need them in the context of just one project? Do we need them in the context of one site collection? Or do we really need them everywhere? And that's going to actually make a difference between do I do my content type definition inside of a site collection, or do I syndicate my content types through a content type hub, which is really useful, but it's actually somewhat limiting, which we'll get to. Right, so you don't want to default to this cross-site collection content type thing unless you really need it, because even though it sounds like a good idea to just say, well, let me start from the beginning coming from this authoritative source, there's actually some drawbacks when you do that, which I'll go into. And then finally, what is your policy, forget SharePoint for a second, in general about the ability to override or self-define content types or extend is probably the most common one, extending content types. Maybe you have a scenario where you have a user, right, and you want to impose a required metadata field called, you know, department or a cost center or something like that goes onto every document or client or something like that. Well, if you do that through a content type in a site collection, they can actually extend that. If you do it in a content type hub, no dice, right? So you got to be careful there. That little decision makes a big difference. Okay, after you plan, you go through deployment. So what are the things around deployment that you need to worry about, right? Well, you want to define your site columns, templates, and workflows. Well, how do you do that, first of all? Are you doing that manually through a tool, something else? You want to distinguish between, again, your enterprise content types, your site-level content types, and then there's a third category, ad hoc tags, which is sort of, you need to figure out, wait a minute, we want ad hoc tags, meaning we're not going to define what our content types are, but what do we mean when we say ad hoc tags? Do we mean authoritative metadata, or do we mean social tagging, right? Because authoritative metadata is the ability for someone to create a column, but only the user who is the editor or creator or whatever can actually change that metadata property, and there's one value that it can ever hold at a time, right? Whereas social tagging is a completely different animal, where I can put things and actually have, you know, a 500 people in my organization actually add an attribute to my document, which I can also use for searching and filtering, but in a different way. So you want to distinguish between what you really need there. You also want to potentially define a dedicated site collection, so it's not inside the existing site collection, it's a separate dedicated one for a content type hub for anything you want to do across site collections. Maybe. And the maybe is where we'll talk through, you know, the pros and cons of doing that. You also want to make sure, just like everything else in SharePoint, that you want to actually work properly, that it has ownership and a governance plan. So if you don't care what really happens, then just do whatever you feel like doing. But if you actually want consistency and reliability, someone has to own and be responsible for the consistency and validation of content types and then how they're used, right? And whether that sits in IT as the SharePoint central admin, you know, person, or it sits in another center of excellence kind of group, right, that maybe supports SharePoint and liaises with the business, that's actually something you want to consider in your organization. How many people actually have a sort of SharePoint center of excellence? Okay, the ones that don't, try to create one. How's that for advice? And here's the problem. You're short-staffed, it's probably you. Yeah, I'm the center of excellence right here. I'm also the Exchange center of excellence, all right? Right? Happens actually pretty commonly. I get your center of excellence right here. Okay, so anyway, it's Thursday, you can tell, can't you? All right, so three, you got planning, you've got deployment, and then you've got management. Once you actually deploy, who's going to manage this stuff? It actually can get really complicated very quickly if you're not careful, right? You want to make sure you're deploying some of these things in test to you know, make sure your behavior is as intended. But if you're creating columns on the fly, creating them in test almost seems overkill, right? So you have to figure out, what's my, you know, get to production strategy? Am I actually going through test, or am I actually going right into production? And it really depends on the level of rigor that you want to apply to your content type strategy. You also want to be aware of cross-farm issues with content types. If you actually publish a content type in test, those content types, you see names as a user, like column whatever says, you know, cost center is the name of it. Under the covers, that's actually a GUID. SharePoint doesn't care what the name of it is, it cares what the GUID is. And if you do things across farm, you've got to be really careful about this cross-farm GUID issue, which we'll talk about a little more. You also want to train users. We always forget this step, but when do I use a content type? When don't I? What am I supposed to do when I see a document library and ask me for the content type? What am I supposed to do with it? Like, what's my training? What do I have to do? What can I do? What should I do? Right? So if you don't have a can, should, must in your organization, you know, you want to think about that. Otherwise, maybe you shouldn't be using content types. So yes, I just said, unless you have a well-defined governance, you know, policy for how users are going to make use of columns and workflows and stuff, then you probably aren't ready for using content types in the way that you probably think. That's my opinion. You can hate me if you want. Okay. Construct a plan for management over the lifecycle. So again, what happens going forward? What if you need to change an attribute or change a workflow or a retention schedule? Who's going to do it? Who's responsible for that? And then how do you regression test all the other stuff in SharePoint that's reliant on that content type? All right, I'm going to hand it over to Chris, because I've been talking for a long time, as you know, because I did the last session. Chris, why don't you take it away? And right. Chris will talk about working with columns and maybe go under the covers a little bit.
Great, thanks, Scott. You guys hear me all right? You guys doing okay? All right. So as Scott mentioned, we're going to talk a bit now about how you manage columns and what some of the challenges around working with columns. The first point, as Scott just mentioned, is that the GUID, the Guaranteed Unique Identifier, that is the actual key that SharePoint cares about. It's not the display name. It's not the internal name. That's true not only for the columns that you create, it's also true for the columns that SharePoint creates and manages as well. So often what you'll find is that SharePoint makes copies of columns all over the place. Sometimes the column has the same name, but it's actually using the same GUID. Sometimes it's the same name with a different GUID. Sometimes it's the same GUID with a different name. Does that make sense? You guys all drink last night? It's perfect sense, right? So it's very confusing sometimes, both as a IT professional developer, but also as an end user to understand, well, gee, in this site collection, it's named description, but over here it's called comments, and over there it's called Bob, called whatever. But when I go ahead and make a change, why am I not seeing that update being reflected across all these different places? when you're working in the SharePoint user interface, so I'm actually working in the UI to create a column, update, manage a column, all of the visible properties on that screen, whether or not you change them, actually get pushed down to the copies of the column that are being used elsewhere. So what that means is if you go in and you change the name and there's some other attributes that are on there that you didn't touch, and someone else further on had actually kind of derived and done something on top of that, you're actually going to push that down on top of what they did. But if you're using the object model, if you're in PowerShell, if you're in Visual Studio, and you only update specific attributes, and then you push that through, it's only going to update the attributes that you specifically edited. So the user interface, you touch one thing, whatever's on the screen, it pushes everything down and overwrites whatever was done at a lower level. Use the object model, you update one attribute, it only updates that single attribute that you asked it to do. So before you're ready to push columns down, and folks understand what I mean by push down, I've got things at a site collection, it's a site column, it's a site collection level. I want to go ahead and say publish this and update anything else that's using this column. Before you push that down, what you often want to do is you want to find out typically what columns are being used. You want to understand how they're configured, so what lists are using that column. You want to think about, is it being used at the site level, at the list level, which content types contain a reference to that column? And you want to understand, is it a local column that was created at the list level, at the library level, or is it something that was a copy from someone that was done at the parent site? So what I'm wondering is, do any of you have reports that you're using today? Because SharePoint doesn't provide the reporting and the visibility to do what we just told you. Any of you doing any custom reports today to look at column usage? No one? Any of you wish that you could do some column reporting and usage? All right. So Scott mentioned, we're not going to go into a lot of code here. We realize it's Thursday morning, the second to last session of the conference, but we do have a present for you. So we have a number of folks on the SharePoint development team actually built some utilities for reporting on columns and reporting on content types. We're going to go through some of the outputs of those reports, and we're going to give you that code after the conference. So if you... Here's the catch. Here's the catch. We're going to audit the eval scores. Anyone that doesn't give us fives across the board, you're not going to get the report.
Wow.
No, I'm just kidding. But in all seriousness, we're going to, after the conference, we're working on how we can distribute it. It may be on MSDN. What I'd suggest is Scott and I will both tweet it out through Twitter. We have our Twitter handles at the end. So if you want to follow us, we'll get that out probably within the next week. There's a bunch of different examples that we've also created for managing, creating content types and columns that we're going to give you guys as well. So again, we didn't really want to go through all the code right now. We want to focus more on the concepts and how to apply it and how to interpret the report. So here's a basic scenario. I've gone into SharePoint, and I've created a new content type that I'm very original. I called it My Sales Proposal. Its parent is another content type that I created that's called Sales Proposal. So Sales Proposal derived from the document content type. My Sales Proposal inherits what was done at the Sales Proposal level, and then it actually extends that. So if you look at this, you'll see that I have four columns. I have the default title column. I have the company name and the deal owner, which are columns that came from my parent content type. And then I created a brand new column that is within my sales proposal. So it makes sense? I've got two levels of inheritance going on. I've got my base content type of sales proposal that inherits from document. I've got my sales proposal content type that inherits from sales proposal. And then within that, I've defined a custom column that extends that. So when we run this report, that again you guys are going to get, I've kind of formatted, done a little bit of formatting on it, and I've kind of taken some data out. But basically what I've done here is you're seeing that here's the web, here's the site, the root site collection is called Contoso. Here is a subsite called Demo Sales Site. Within that, I actually have additional libraries. So what you're looking at here across the top, these are some of the attributes we're reporting on. So is it a web, is it a site, or is it a list? What's the path to that? So what does the user see when they're navigating that? What's the name of the column? This long, nasty, ugly string, this is the GUID, right? This is what SharePoint cares about. So it's going to spit out the GUID. Again, you can see here I hit a bunch of columns. There are hundreds and hundreds of base columns that SharePoint ships with. This utility will actually go through, and anything that is a hidden column that never gets shown anywhere, it doesn't report out on. But even just looking at all of the columns that SharePoint ships with that are actually visible and used somewhere within the system, there are hundreds of columns. I figured you didn't want to see the ones that SharePoint shipped with. You'd want to look at, you know, three of the ones that I actually configured. And what you're seeing here is that at the root site collection level, here is the company name that was attached to the the sales proposal content type that I defined at the top level. And then you'll see there's another instance of that. And number one and number two, what this means is that that same company name column is used in two different places. So the first copy of that column exists at the root site collection. The second copy of that column, company name two, in this case it actually has the same name, shares the same GUID, but there's something different about it, meaning it could have a different group. You know, when you create a column, you say, what group does that belong in? My custom columns, you know, the default SharePoint groups that are out there. There's something different about this column. These utilities also, if you want, can actually dump out the raw XML. So if you wanted to do a diff and see what's the difference between them and kind of why did the report detect and flag it as being different, you can actually do that as well. So again, looking at this report, what's pretty helpful is you can find that here are my three custom columns. Here is that deal amount column that I created that was based on my local content type, my sales proposal content type, that was actually defining a local column. And we're going to get into looking at the content type view of this as well. So I wanted to give you a quick flavor for the utility we're going to give you and how to interpret and read that. Does this seem like something that's reasonably helpful to folks? All right. So that's fun. Columns make sense. Copies, GUIDs, great. Now let's take that challenge, because I work for Microsoft, so everything's a challenge, an opportunity. Scott doesn't work for Microsoft, so he's a little more blunt and direct. But let's take, and you know, we have great fun working together on the book and how I want to position things and how he wants to call it. But basically, let's look at content types. Is anyone in this room not familiar with content types? I'm assuming you're all in a 300-level session. You have a base understanding of it. Scott just did a definition of kind of when you would use content types and what's your strategy. But the key thing to know is it's something that you can associate at a site, so site collection or site, as well as at a list level. Again, they have references to the columns, so they actually have a pointer back to the column that it's being used. They typically, well, they always inherit from a parent. So SharePoint has a number of base content types, right? A document, an item, a blog post, a wiki, et cetera. You're always, when you're creating a custom content type, inheriting from something. But you can also, as you saw in my example, inherit from your own content type. So if you wanted to have something where you define a corporate-wide sales proposal, but you have different business units, and they want to extend the corporate sales proposal, but then have local attributes that are specific to, you know, Division A versus Division B, where they at least share some common base, but again, they kind of extend it, you can do that. We're going to talk about this. You can change the copies of the content types sometimes. In fact, you know, Scott and I were debating this. Sometimes maybe we let you change things that we probably shouldn't encourage you to change, because as you're going to see, like a lot of things in SharePoint, sometimes we let you hurt yourself. And if you're not careful or don't understand what's happening, it can cause you some problems. So Scott mentioned that, you know, I was a customer. Spent about 14 years as a customer. So I've been working with SharePoint since 2001. So I've lived some of these challenges myself. So I've been through a lot of what you guys are working with as well. So again, we've got another report that we're going to give you. There's two utilities. There's a content type report that we've created. So what this report's going to help you understand is which content types are used on which lists. It's going to help you understand how they relate to the parent content types. And it's also going to tell you how many specific list items, so how many instances of that content type are being used. So I have a sales proposal. How many times has someone actually gone in and said, new sales proposal from the menu? How many times have they uploaded a document and attached that content type? So how many instances of that content type are actually being used in a list or library? So this is that example, you know, not as sexy as the other one. And actually, when you run this report, it actually has all of the columns that I showed you earlier. And then there's a lower section within the report that shows the content types. So again, what I've kind of abstracted out here is here's my root site collection, here's my site. I'm seeing that here's my sales proposal content type. And it's defined at the sales library level. And then within there, I actually have a shared documents library. And you can see that here's instance one of it. Here's instance two of that column. And you can see that I actually have 44 places where my sales proposal content type are actually being used. So you want to think about, you know, when you're saying, go ahead and push down updates to this content type. Do we want to push those down? Well, how many documents already exist that are using that content type? As well as how many times is that content type being inherited and used by other lists and libraries you may not be thinking about? Somewhat helpful? And just so you know, we love gratuitous applause. It makes us feel good.
Thank you, right
Thank
there.
Thank you. I'm sorry, is there a question? Great question. Yeah, so usages, that means that there are 44 documents in the shared documents library that are of type sales proposal. Yeah, question. Yeah, so the question is, how will this report work with a previous version of SharePoint? So this report was originally created based on SharePoint 2010. To be honest with you, there were very minor modifications we made to make this work with 2013. Basically, had to change some of the references, had to do some things to handle the new, you guys have seen the news feed that you've probably seen demos of social. Well, that news feed is actually a type of content type. It's a hidden list, which actually, it's a list that's visible, but it's not really used, called the micro feed. That list didn't really behave normally as a content type, so we're suppressing that. So the short story is that this tool you can use for 2010 or 2013. I don't know if it would actually... Thank you. You guys are great. I got to bring you home with me.
By the way, it's Thursday.
And he's only
one
more
session. There we go.
So the short story is that this is working with 2010 or 2013. I haven't tried it against 2007. The other thing to know is that this utility is written as something that is using the server-side object model. So for this implementation, you need to run it on the web front end, basically run it on the server. You could, we didn't go through and do this, you could convert it to use the new client-side object model. So if you wanted to report against SharePoint Online, if you didn't want to run it actually on the server, you could use the new object model. For simplicity, we just kept it running. It's a local dev environment. I'm just running it as a farm level. You know, I'm logged in as the admin, and I'm just going ahead and running this report directly logged onto the server. All right, so we're going to shift gears a little bit. We talked about how you can report on and manage columns. We talked about how you can report on and manage content types. We want to focus a little bit of time talking about the options for creating content types and modifying content types. That's really the essence of the session. After I'm done with this module, Scott's going to come up and kind of take kind of the practical, you know, kind of high-level theory that I'm talking about and apply it to a practical customer use case example. So basically, we see that there are five ways of managing content types. We're going to walk through each of these. We're going to talk about what we perceive as the pros and cons of each of these. And then again, Scott's going to come up and he's going to go through a customer example. Thank you. So the first way you can do this is by just using the default out-of-the-box site or site collection, which is kind of the basic example. We're then going to talk about content type syndication. We're then going to go through a little bit of PowerShell. Any IT pros in the room? Okay, so we're going to go through a little bit of PowerShell for you guys. We're also going to talk through a little bit of Visual Studio, so any developers in the room? All right, about half and half. So we're trying to balance, we're saying, gee, it's an IT pro session. How many IT pros really want to go through Visual Studio? How many developers want to go through PowerShell? So we kind of have a balance of them. So we're going to show some examples and talk through the pros and cons. We're also going to talk about the category that, I don't know if any of our ISV partners in the room. There are a number of partners. I hate to name names. I tell folks I have four kids. I try to love them all equally. I work for Microsoft, I have many partners, I try to love them all equally. But again, I wanted to give you the option that there are at least four partners that actually have solutions that you can purchase. So AvePoint, Exceller, Metalogix, Quest. If you don't want to use the utility we're going to give you to report on things, if you wanted to do something beyond just using PowerShell or Visual Studio, the content type syndication hub, to actually manage and create those content types, there are some third-party tools out there. And I apologize if you're from an ISV and you're not on this list. Again, I was just trying to be fair and at least have a couple in the category. So the first example is kind of similar to the example we just talked about. You can go into the user interface at the site level or at the site collection level. You can go in and say site content types. You can go ahead and create your content type, you know, specify whether what the parent is of it. You can do things like define workflow settings, define retention policies, add new columns, or add columns that already exist, so existing site columns. This is kind of the basic scenario that most folks are used to. This is probably typically the thing that you're delegating to some of your business users. Any business users in the room before I offend anybody? Okay. No, I'm just teasing. So again, there's a lot of things that we can do through the product that, from a business perspective, the average business user, frankly, may not understand nor care what SharePoint's doing under the covers. We want to help educate folks on what some of the implications are in doing some of these things. So this is the basic scenario that most business groups are probably using to create content types, if they're doing them at all. So the pros of this, it's out of the box, right? If you want to, you can delegate it, let your end users create and manage their own content types. The cons is, in most organizations, there's really a lack of change management, right? Typically, these columns, these content types are created live in production. People may or may not understand this concept of push down. They may push something down, something might get broken. They call the IT pro and say, gee, this thing's busted, go ahead and fix it. I've been on the receiving end of some of those calls, right? And the other thing is just the out-of-the-box site or site collection level, it's scoped to a single site collection, right? So best case, someone creates it at the root site collection. Maybe they create it at the subsite. Maybe they're three sites deep in there, and they say, gee, I want to now use this column, and I want to share it across other sites within the site collection. They then need to go back and recreate it at the top level if they have permission, and then the lower subsets can actually have access to it and inherit that. The second example we want to talk about is the content type hub. Anyone using the content type hub today? Those of you who have your hands up, keep them up for a second. How many of you like the content type hub and want to continue to use it? A few hands went down. Okay. Most of them stayed up. Okay, good. So the content type hub was introduced in SharePoint 2010. It's still there in SharePoint 2013. It didn't receive really any updates. So again, some core things, some bug fixes, other things were done. But really, the content type hub in SharePoint 2013 is essentially the same as it was in 2010. It allows you to create content types that can be shared across site collections, but also across farms. So I'm going to walk through some diagrams that actually talk about how this works, because about half of the room seem like they're not using the content type syndication hub today. And what basically happens is, as I'll show you, is you define and create the content types at what's called a hub. So there's a site collection that serves as the source of content types for your organization. And they get published to consumers. So basically, other web apps, other site collections subscribe to these content types. And they go through what's called syndication, where when new content types get published or updates get published, they can receive copies of that content type that they can work with within their site collections. So what happens when you publish a new content type? So basically, again, a content type gets published from a normal site collection. Typically, you'll dedicate a site collection within the organization to serve as a content type hub. We'll talk about some of the challenges on that in a second. You'll also have to use the managed metadata service. So folks familiar with the managed metadata service, right? It came in 2010 as well. The key thing to know here is that the managed metadata service does not have to consume from a content type hub. It's optional. Conversely, you can use the content type syndication hub without actually using the managed metadata service to manage enterprise metadata, or you can do both, right? So you can have the managed metadata service that just does metadata. You can have the managed metadata service that actually helps to do syndication of content types, or you can have a managed metadata service that does both. It manages enterprise keywords and content and metadata, and it also manages the syndication of the content types. Basically, what happens is inside of your tenant admin, or your farm admin, rather, inside of a central admin in SharePoint, you go into the managed metadata service, and after you have that site collection created, you specify in the properties of the managed metadata service what the location is, what's the URL of the site collection that you want to serve as the site collection that is managing your content types. And then basically you go into the properties of the instance of that service, and you define basically whether you want it to do things like roll up errors. And then once you go ahead and do that, all of the other site collections and web apps that are subscribing to that, you can specify which web apps will consume that content type hub. You can then go into those site collections later on and say whether or not it wants to take those changes down. And we'll talk through that in a second. So what gets published from the content type syndication hub? So first off, the content types and any associated columns that are related to that get published. This includes the document set content types. So a lot of times folks ask questions because a document set is a type of content type. Those also get published. The policies, so Scott talked about retention policies. How long do we keep documents? Those get published. This is the tricky one, right? So if you're using workflows and you have a workflow attached to a content type, we will publish the workflow association from the content type syndication hub to all of the child site collections and web apps that are subscribing. We do not copy the workflow. So what that means is when you go ahead and say, push down this content type, it has an approval workflow attached to it, the site collections that are subscribing to that will get basically the notification that this content type has a workflow. It will look to see if the workflow exists within the site collection. If it doesn't, it will actually register an error to say, hey, I need this workflow. The workflow doesn't exist. I'm not going to try and create it, because if you've worked with workflow, you know there's some intricacies around how workflows get wired up to lists, and there's some similar challenges, as Scott mentioned, around GUIDs when you're kind of pushing these things around. So if you are working with workflows, you may want to look at either using some third-party tools or some PowerShell scripts to actually, if you want to programmatically push those workflow around, or make sure that when you're doing that, you're checking for those errors, and you're going in there and manually creating the workflows that are required. Again, your content type's not going to fail. You can still use it. Just the workflow that's associated won't actually be fired. So when you're working in the content type hub, There are basically four activities. I mentioned when you're setting this up inside of the managed metadata service, you can specify whether or not you want to publish, unpublish, republish, basically saying when you're working inside of that site collection, that's your hub. If you go ahead and make a change, you add a column, and you want to publish that out again to all the consumers. You can also specify if you want to get rolled up errors. So think about a case where maybe there are 50 different site collections that are consuming the content type syndication. Well, you probably don't want to go to 50 different site collections to see all the different errors, right? You probably want to go to a single place, but you also want to provide the option for the people that are working within the site collection to locally see if there are any errors for them as a subscriber. So we support both, seeing errors at the consumer, but also seeing errors from an overall enterprise perspective and see that rolled up error reporting. On the consumer side of things, this is where we wanted you to make sure that you were careful, because I was actually playing around with this. So a lot of what we're doing, we did a lot of trial and error, we did some review, we had some debate on how we thought it would work and how we actually thought it should work. This is an example where Scott and I actually were testing some stuff out. So on the consumer side, so I'm a site collection that's subscribing to the content type syndication hub. I have a content type that gets copied down. By default, that content type is read-only, which means I can go ahead and create instances of items that use that content type, but I can change that read-only property to say, I want to make this read-write. SharePoint then allows me to go ahead and do things like add another column and change things in my copy. Well, here's what happens. Scott then goes ahead in the content type syndication hub and changes that content type, and he goes ahead and adds something, and he republishes that, and it pushes that content type down to me. Guess what SharePoint does? It trashes what I did locally, so it blows away that column that I just added. It goes ahead and puts down a new copy of that content type and obliterates any changes that I made locally. All right? So again, just something to think about. But again, on the consumer side, you can extend it if you want to. But again, we think that it's read-only by default. We think that it probably should just be read-only, because that's something that folks don't really understand, and the UI doesn't really tell you that this is something that could happen. But again, you can review import errors, et cetera. So let's talk about how this actually works. So in my example here, we have two farms. Those farms are they're sharing a single managed metadata service across farm. My managed metadata service is living inside of farm 2. You can see that each farm has two web apps. Within each farm, I also have two site collections. So you can see the farm on the right actually has three site collections. The farm on the left has two site collections. All right, so this is kind of the basic world that we're living in. I want to go ahead and set up content type syndication so that all of these different site collections actually have the same content types across my organization. So what happens is, if I wanted to, I could have the managed metadata service look at a local site collection that's within my web app. But you don't have to do that. You could also say, if you wanted to, that my managed metadata service is actually going to consume a site collection that's in a different web app within inside of the same farm. What happens is, as I go ahead and publish things from my site collection, it actually publishes it to the service, so it takes a cab file that basically takes the definition of those content types, the metadata, the columns, the workflow associations, all those things, it publishes those. And then basically a timer job goes ahead and it looks for the changes, the content types that are there, and it goes ahead and it pushes those changes out to all of the different site collections that are subscribing to a copy of that. Right? So in this case, I have one site collection that's being used just to manage my enterprise content types, and I have, in this case, four other consumer site collections that are actually getting copies of that as I'm publishing content types out. So again, I just described this before. Those are read-only by default. So what happens now when I want to go ahead and delete a content type? So in this example, I go ahead and delete the content type from my content type syndication hub. Timer job basically runs, notifies that there is a delete event that has to happen. SharePoint basically then goes ahead and runs that timer job, goes out to all of the site collections that are subscribed, and it goes ahead and deletes the content type. But what happens now is, we don't actually go ahead and delete the content types from the consumers. We flip that bit, so we delete the association between the content type syndication hub and the consumer site collections, but we don't go ahead and delete the content type. Why? Because you could have instances of that content type that are already attached, right? So you could have lists that were based on that content type. So we basically delete the association and flip that bit from being read-only to being read-write. So what that means is, those four consuming site collections now have their own disconnected copy of the content type. Any changes that are made on each of those individual four site collections are not reflected anywhere else. So you basically have four different instances of the same content types that are all managed and used locally. Make sense? All right. So lastly, let's just talk about how the error logs work. So again, basically in my example here, maybe I was going ahead and pushing out a content type. Maybe someone had already created a content type locally within their site collection that was named sales proposal. SharePoint at least does check for that and says, hey, you know what? Someone has a sales proposal already here. I'm not going to push a new instance of a content type named the same thing. I'm going to register an error. It's also going to look for things like, again, I'm pushing out a workflow association. The workflow doesn't exist. Each of those site collections that have the error, if you go into their site collection, you can actually see what the errors are that exist. And then, again, with inside of the content type syndication hub, you'll actually see that it pushes back a copy of all the errors, and I can get an enterprise view from the content type syndication hub of all of the errors across all of my farms as well as all of my different site collections. So last example, we're showing this in an example of kind of dev test. Scott, I know, has also used this in other cases where maybe there are multiple subsidiaries within a company, so maybe there are multiple production instances, and you may want to do some daisy chaining, right? So you want to have basically one source environment that's actually then having some sort of workflow and approval around it, and then it's being published and consumed out. So in this example, I have a dev test environment where there's some basic workflow happening. I then have my production content type syndication hub that's basically pulling from a timer job the information that's published to the site collection in my dev environment, pulling it up into production. I then have a managed metadata service, and I have an instance of the content type syndication hub that's in production that then all of my other farms and site collections that are consuming that in production are basically consuming from a production instance of the content type syndication hub, which in turn is actually pulling its information from another place. So what you're seeing again is actually content types that are being managed and kind of approved within a lower region, or it could be a different production farm, but basically all of the other production environments are not connecting to the dev environment. They're connecting through a single production instance of the content type syndication hub, which just happened to be getting a copy from some other place. And then that's kind of an idea of daisy chaining those environments.
So would you describe this as a content type hub publishing to a subscriber, which is also actually a content type hub for other subscribers?
Exactly. That's a much better way of describing it. Thanks. You applauded for him or me or both? All right. Good. All right. So here's that UI I was talking about with inside of the content type publishing. So this is inside of the content type syndication hub. So this is the site collection that's publishing to the company. You can see I have publish, unpublish, republish as well. So the pros of the content type syndication hub, again, pro, it's out of the box. It's relatively simple to configure. Again, I mentioned basic steps, create a dedicated site collection, have a managed metadata service, go ahead, define that service consumes from a site collection, then basically go ahead and associate that with the web apps, and then basically from there, these timer jobs are going to run that basically publish and consume those content types. If you wanted to, you could allow an end user to manage, because it's just a regular site collection, so you could let an end user manage the content types that are in that syndication hub. And it provides a single source for content types across your organization, across site collections, and across farms. Similar cons, though, right? So if you have an end user that's working within that site collection, they may not understand change management. They may not understand the implications of publishing and republishing things down. It also requires the coordination of a dedicated site collection. So sometimes I think it's, for my example, I basically just created a regular old team site and then used the site collection gallery, the site column gallery and the site content type gallery within that site collection to actually manage this. But, technically people could start putting documents and other things within it because it's just a regular site. So you want to make sure that people know that this site should really just be used to manage the content types. It also does not work in hybrid. So we've talked a lot this week about Office 365. So one of the areas of feedback that we've heard a lot is I might be working in a hybrid environment, right? I may have some SharePoint team sites that are in Office 365. I might still have some on-premises team sites, and I want to have a single set of content types that work between on-premises and online. The content type syndication hub only works within that environment. So within Office 365, you can have a content type syndication hub that works across all of your site collections in the cloud. On-premises, you can have a content type syndication hub that works across all your farms and site collections on-premises. What you cannot do is bridge the two, all right? So there are a lot of examples out there, PowerShell scripts. Again, there are some third parties that bridge that gap for us. It's something that, again, we get feedback on, so it's something that I'm no idea on timing, but I know the engineering teams are looking at that. So just realize that out of the box, they do not publish across on-premises and online. Each of those environments would have their own instance of a content type syndication hub. It is true of the Charmster as well. Yep. So quick comparison, site collection content types. Thanks. I keep forgetting to move that pointer away.
I'm with you.
All right, so site collection content types, again, can be used by a site collection and within those subsites. They can be extended, and any changes that you make on the child sites get preserved. So SharePoint, when you push things down, are not going to go ahead and overwrite those columns that you changed. The content type syndication hub, again, it has the benefit of content types being used across site collections and farms. By default, remember, those content types are read-only in the consumers. You can change that, but be careful. But again, because if you do change the default and you do make a change to the copy of the content type that's in the consuming site and you go ahead and republish that, you may have your changes get overwritten by the publishing hub. So that's option two, right? So we talked about doing it within the base site collection. We talked about the content type syndication hub. The next example we want to talk through is actually using PowerShell. So again, this is a very basic rudimentary example. What I'm showing here is basically creating a brand new column. It's called proposal. I think it's just of type, I think I just defined it as a type of text. So it's just a field type text. And basically I'm creating that new column. I'm adding that column to the site. And then basically I'm creating a brand new content type. You know, I'm very original in my demos, right? So I'm just calling it my PowerShell demo content type. I'm putting it in a group with a description. And then I'm basically adding two existing columns that already exist, so start date and end date, as well as that brand new proposal column that I just created above. And then I'm going ahead and updating that and basically committing my column and content type to SharePoint. So very basic example. Obviously, you can do things like extend this, so handle modifications. You probably would want to put some error checking in there that do things like make sure that if the column exists or the content types exist, make sure that either you update it or you give some sort of prompt. In this example, if I run this multiple times with the same name, it'll throw an error and tell me that that column exists or that content type exists. A very basic example of actually deploying columns and content types via PowerShell. I'm sorry, I can't hear the question. It was a question, why are you not seeing the identifier for the GUID? Because I'm creating the column. And then in this case, SharePoint's just going to go ahead and define the GUID for me. And then when I'm adding the columns, you see down here, I'm actually referring to them by their name as opposed to the specific GUID. So obviously, if you wanted to and you want to be precise on using the GUIDs based on the problems you mentioned before, you'd want to go ahead and basically get the GUID and then put that GUID in to make sure that same GUID is being used. So the pros, it's relatively quick and simple. Obviously, you can be much more complex than this. It's repeatable, so you know that if it runs in one environment this way, it's going to run consistently in other environments. And typically, when it's done by an IT pro or developer, you typically have formal change management processes that go around how these things get deployed. The con, based on your perspective, is that it requires someone in IT to do something, so it's not something an end user typically will do. Your environment may vary. I see some smiles. You also need to think about how you're going to manage updates, right? So the content type syndication hub knows how to handle pushes of updates. You want to think about the lifecycle, right? So it's easy to create a column in a content type. How do you manage updates? How do you manage deletes? How do you manage things, as Scott mentioned, across site collections and across farms? The next example is basically working with inside of Visual Studio. And basically, I've got two different examples here. I think typically you'll see things done in the first example, which is using a feature. So I basically just used the out-of-the-box Visual Studio templates. I went ahead and created a new item. So basically, I created a new column using new item, new site column. And then I created basically a new content type. User interface lets me put in the name, put in a description, specify who it inherits from, basically go ahead and add additional columns. I've also gone ahead and just used a basic example, similar to what you do inside of PowerShell. Basically, if I wanted to create a console app or a batch file, that could basically go ahead and create new columns, go ahead and create new content types, and then associate things like columns to that content type, associate document templates, retention policies, et cetera. So again, a very similar example of how you could use Visual Studio to package things up either as part of a feature. So I'm building a new web part. I want to make sure that when I deploy that, I have a consistent experience as far as site columns and site content types that are related to my web part. I package that up with a feature. I then get the ability to deploy that feature as part of a regular package. Or again, I want to do some sort of ad hoc one-off thing. Again, if I don't want to use PowerShell, I could do a similar thing using the object model inside of a console app as an example or a batch file. So pros and cons, very similar to the PowerShell example, in my opinion. Typically, again, I think you're going to see folks doing this as part of a feature. You could do it as a standalone app. Everything else is pretty much the same. Repeatable, change management. Again, typically requires someone in IT to go ahead and do this as a developer. Now, you know, thinking about things in 2013 with the extension of the client-side object model to expose things more through the client side, I could see, you know, examples where, you know, in the past a developer might have had to do things because you required someone to install and deploy something at the farm. Now with the advent of some of the new, you know, CSOM, you know, the client-side object model and remote PowerShell, in theory, if it's a business person that's savvy with PowerShell and savvy with, you know, using the client-side object model, which Scott and I both agree probably is not going to happen, but not out of the realm of possibility that someone in theory, in fact, this is actually how a lot of these things happen when you're deploying to Office 365, because we do not allow you to install things at the farm level. We require you to actually use the object model via remote PowerShell or through the client-side object model to actually create and manage your columns and content types. And that's how our third-party ISVs actually do their job of moving things from on-premises to online. Most of them, especially now in 2013, are doing things through the object model client-side as opposed to installing in the server. So with that, just kind of wrapping up the last example, third-party tools, I think a great thing about it is if you don't want to be in the business of managing and developing your own tools, you could go out and purchase a third-party tool that, or you may already own an existing tool that you're using for other things, and maybe you're not using it for reporting and creating and managing columns and content types. And again, if hybrid's an important scenario to you, you're going to live in this on-premises online world, many of the third-party tools actually help us to cross the chasm. You know, the obvious con to me is, you know, it's additional money you have to spend. But again, it's the whole build versus buy decision. And I think we've shown you a couple of different examples of out-of-the-box features, and we've shown you some different examples of things you could build. Scott's going to walk through a real-world customer example and just kind of wrap us up.
All right, so I'm going to take us home by giving you a little story of what really happened with a client of mine. So customer scenario, they're a pharmaceutical company. They've got a whole bunch of employees around the world, a lot of regulated content, things like that. So they wanted to use content types to lock things down. Seemed like a reasonable scenario, right? So I want to take you through real quick the goals, design, challenges, and what we actually came up with. So first one is the goals. So what were the goals? It was a desire to have consistent values for content across team sites. So this was a collaboration scenario where we said, hey, listen, we want to make sure when people put things into team sites, we're actually capturing a few elementary pieces of information from users, which seemed reasonable, right? We also wanted the ability for the business users to extend their libraries to capture additional columns because they could be more productive, they're more empowered to do things, right? By the way, this combination is already spelling death for the content type hub. Just those two requirements, okay? That's the thing I want you to realize very quickly, is that if you have these two requirements, the content type hub, you should start thinking like danger, danger, right? And I'll talk about that in a second. So they wanted to enforce retention policies. They wanted to make sure they had a consistent experience around, you know, what metadata values they're capturing, but allow that extension of those. So what was design at first? Well, site columns, that seemed to make sense. Content types, those make sense, no-brainers. Hold on. We had a requirement that I didn't list, which was using these across all the different site collections within the organization. And they probably had, you know, several dozen collaborative site collections. It seemed reasonable. You know, there's a lot of scale that needed to happen, right? Because what's the main reason we separate site collections into multiple site collections, sites into multiple site collections? What's the biggest problem? Security is a big one, but the biggest one I've seen is the content database size, right, grows and grows and grows, and you don't want to have this 52 terabyte content database that you're lugging around, right? It's probably a little on the big side. So you actually scale that by partitioning into multiple content types, multiple content databases, which forces you into multiple site collections. It forces you there, right? So what do I do when I want a content type across site collections? Well, that's what the content type hub is for. The issue, though, right, is that the client, which I mentioned a minute ago, needed to both push down mandatory columns on all documents and allow the business users the ability to add their own columns. This actually works great within the context of a site collection, right, where I can extend those columns, and if I go up to the parent content type, it's a true inheritance model where I'm extending that content type, and it won't break my extension to that in, you know, let's say a library that I've extended it or something like that. However, the content type hub, because it actually takes a copy and just slaps it on top and overwrites me, then I actually lose any changes that I've extended. And actually, I can't even extend those changes by default because they're set to read-only, as Chris mentioned. So if I'm a business user and I see some content types, right, I'm really confused why I can't add columns to them. And then if I'm a really ambitious user, I start exploring all the different buttons in SharePoint you can press, right? And then I see one that says content type is, and there's two radio buttons. One says read-only and one says write. And I say, or editable, changeable, whatever it says. And guess what? I go, oh, that looks cool. So I click it. And then I'm like, wow, look at all these extensions. So even if your one of your requirements wasn't number two, it was just that you wanted to push down mandatory columns, but you didn't want people to extend it. And you just said, hey, business user, you're a power user, you're good at SharePoint, you know, just go to town. And they didn't even tell you that they went in there and changed that from read-only to write, because what? Guess what? SharePoint lets you do that as a user if you have permissions. And then they started going to town on their own columns. And then like 6 weeks later, they're like, hey, why did my content type completely break that I spent hours and hours and hours and hours and hours working on? And you're like, oh, I pushed down a new update to that global one we have. And you just trash them because you weren't, you know, communicating with them, because you didn't know that they were going to do something crazy like that because they're a user. And they didn't realize that there was a limitation on that read-only aspect, right? Now, if they were using a content type that was just inherited within a site collection, not a problem. It's the fact that the content type hub pushes and overwrites subscribers. So it's not possible to do both, at least with the out-of-the-box content type hub the way it's designed, right? So the point I made at the beginning is that sometimes content types are actually too heavy. Right, from a design perspective, they actually work great if you have a very restricted scenario and you're not going to let people change that read-only setting to write and start extending them. Then the content type hub works, but it's actually a major challenge of the content type hub is that aspect, right? So many sites, along with, you know, site-level updates, create a situation where nobody even knows what these content types are doing. Like, who's extended them, who hasn't? Or should they be extending them, should they not? What is our policy here? So this is where knowing how content types work in detail and then knowing the side effects of not planning that properly, you can actually get yourself into trouble. So what we did for this client is we said, hey, listen, we're actually going to adjust the use of enterprise content types for just contracts, which we found out was the real requirement, that only contracts really needed to be consistent. And we didn't care if they extended them with their own properties, because contracts had a defined set of metadata that everybody agreed upon, and we all got along and hugged and kissed, and we said, contracts are going to be this way. And all the other stuff you do, we don't care. Go to town and add columns. So we separated what's really needs to be consistent, and it's truly consistent. So we made sure that we went into SharePoint, and we changed that radio button so that they couldn't even change it from read-only to something else. Because SharePoint lets people shoot themselves in the foot, but we changed it so you couldn't, right? No matter what permissions you had, right? And then we said, well, the stuff that doesn't need to be locked down, don't make it a content type in the content type syndication hub, because you're overkill. Don't do that. So basically, the idea is to think a little bit more about how you do that. Now, if you do actually have a situation, and I'll talk about that in a second, where you need to do that, I'll actually talk about that momentarily. The other thing we did is not only adjusted the use of those, but again, we train users. We said, hey, listen, here's what's going on. You don't want to know the ugly details, but let's prevent users from actually shooting themselves in the foot, and let's right-size our use of content types. We also created PowerShell scripts that if we did need the rare situation, okay, where we wanted a consistent content type across site collections, but knew the content type hub was going to hurt us. Just wanted to check my sentence there. We used PowerShell to actually make a copy ourselves, which I know is old school, 2007 style. But what that did is it didn't overwrite and clobber the people's changes, because we're making it at the root of the site collection, and it actually lets us cascade normally. So you almost want to think about content types into three buckets. One, that you always are going to be pushing down like Big Brother, right? And you want to make them read-only forever, the content hub is great for that. On the other end of the spectrum, you don't use content type hubs, content types at all. You just let people add columns. And then in the middle, right? Or actually, the other one is you use content types, but you use them in the context of a site collection, and then you don't have any issues there, right? And you can still push them down. And then the middle one is you want to use them across site collections, but you don't want this read-only problem. You want the extension. You actually use PowerShell, which is why we're giving you some of the PowerShell examples. Does that make sense? That's what you have to do. And it doesn't change in 2013, I'm sorry to say. It's the same way, but that's the approach you need to take. And we also created content type reports for better monitoring, which Chris is going to give you because Microsoft, it turns out, actually wrote some on the product team. So we're taking the ones Microsoft wrote, and we're going to give them to you. Where was the applause? Oh, there we go. There we go. Yeah. That was, by the way, that was just for cheap applause. So really, at the end of the day, you want to make sure you have an enterprise content type strategy, meaning there are no enterprise content types. There's content type hub syndication. There's you manually moving them around. There's defining them at the content type level. And then there's not defining them all and letting people create their own columns, right? Working with site columns, understanding that when you create a column, there's a GUID under the covers, and downstream, somebody could actually change the name of that column, but the GUID stays the same, and the user might get confused when we push down a change to that and can potentially impact them with a copy. Managing content types, same concepts there. And then real-world tips. The idea is our customer in this situation, we learned the hard way, actually, through how to use and when not to use content types, and then when to use each of those in a given scenario. So hopefully that our pain and blood and sweat and tears will help you understand when to use them and when not to use them. Because again, they're one of these great features that SharePoint always touts that are great like 25% of the time. And then the other 75% of the time, there's other approaches that you should use, right? And so it's rarely an all or none thing. And that's what I've seen. Clients either go from a none to an all, where really you want to right size and somewhere in the middle. So your strategy, plan, deploy, manage, I mentioned that. Don't do this without planning. GUIDs are the key, not column names, right? Make sure you use those reports to take a look. Content types, they're associated either with a site or a list, right? They contain references to columns, but not the definition themselves, and they do that via the GUID. And the content type hub deploys read-only copies, so that's a really important point. Real-world tips, again, right-sizing your usage of enterprise content types or just content types in general, and then providing training to end users is a big deal. You don't have to provide as much training if you actually use the right-sized approach. If you just use content type hub syndication and don't tell your users that they're read-only but they can actually change into write and get clobbered later, you might not find out for a year because they've changed it to write mode. They're enjoying life. They've created thousands of documents. And then in a year, somebody goes, hey, can we add one more field, one more column to the contract type and just push that down? And then like 52 users call you up and they're like, hey, you screwed our libraries completely. So be careful of that. Use PowerShell as needed, right, for that hybrid approach. Again, it's a little homegrown. If you don't like the hybrid approach, it's okay. There's tools out there that help you manage, right? And there's vendors out in the expo hall that can actually help with some of that. And then use those reports that we're going to give you. So to wrap it up, I think there's some resources here. We'll leave them in the slides. I won't read them all. There's also a couple other good sessions. One is the records management session I just did, and there's one on what's new in ECM that was actually done the other day, but the recording's up there. And with that, fill out your evals, and we'll take questions. So hopefully that was helpful. Question.
First, I just want to say that was a great talk.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to see you guys get it to the depth that we need to understand how the technology works.
Great. Could you turn the mic up somewhere in the back?
With regards, and you guys talked about it a lot, about this limitation of the content hub. I had the very same question myself, because I've actually been going through the libraries and adding custom columns to my content types, which are syndicated from a hub.
Oh, you're in trouble.
I know. But so I had that question, so I went to ask the experts last night, and I talked to the lead engineer for ECM, two of the lead engineers, and they said it's okay as long as you don't touch the columns that are in the content type that's coming from the hub. If you add a column, it's okay. And actually, that is my experience, that when I add a column, it doesn't get stamped over. So I don't know why our experiences are different.
Well, here's the thing. You have to be really careful with that. It most of the time works, but there are times when it doesn't.
Okay, I guess I haven't run into it, but there was warning bells going off in my brain when I saw the dialogue saying, you know, you get a warning dialogue when you do it.
Yep.
But there's a very good business case for actually doing it and adding extending columns. And I haven't run into a problem where it doesn't work, and the lead product engineer told me it was okay. So now you guys are saying it's bad. So I'm kind of, my brain's muddled right now. I would
be careful with doing it, but I think bringing that up is important for us to circle back with him, and maybe we'll tweet out, you know.
That would be really great, because yeah. I don't want to be that unhappy Bob.
Unhappy Bob, exactly.
Yeah. So then the other question is more of a philosophical question. You guys haven't mentioned attaching templates to document types or to content types. We do it a lot. We attach, so you have a standard template comes up with your letterhead on it when you create the content type. But it's only a one-to-one relationship. So you might have a content type which is a report, and you might have 20 flavors of that report with different headings on them, but they all have the same metadata. And there's no way to have different flavors of a content type with different templates.
So you want a one content type to many document template mapping?
Yeah, because it's only the UI that, it's only the template that comes up. It's all the same columns.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah,
there's, you know what my recommendation is there? Don't use content types.
Yeah.
Well, if you're defining the same columns for every document in the organization, for example,
yeah,
then you don't need content types. But your content type is document or whatever
time,
you inherit from
the there, reason so. We're using a content type is that we want the drop down.
Yeah.
We want new report.
I see what you're saying.
And we get a template attached to it.
Then you do need content types. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, there's no current way out of the box to do that multi-mapping.
So we end up creating lots and lots of content types.
So you just made, see that, so I don't like that solution, but that's what you have to do.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Thanks.
Oh, sorry, over this side.
Hi, I've got an answer to that, but I'll deal with that separately.
Okay, what's the answer?
Well, you can actually insert, when you actually go new, the selection of a template, and then you pick the template. So you just got to have the templates up on the site collection. It's a fairly simple change.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you don't do it through the new menu, you do it somewhere
you
else.
You do it off the new menu, but yeah. You intercept it and basically give them the choice of a template, and then
yeah.
Yeah. My question was, with the object model, if you actually do a change in the object model, it only pushes that change down, doesn't it? So does that avoid the site collection copy being clobbered? So if I've done it via the object model, if I've just added, made one small change, it won't clobber the whole. It'll actually only apply that change, won't it?
Right. Yeah, it'll only push down the specific element that you said to change instead of pushing everything else down.
Yeah. So in your presentation, I was thinking, really, the Visual Studio, the object model, really is part of it. You've got to use that approach with the site, with the content type hub for it to work.
It's the same for Visual Studio as well as PowerShell. So anywhere you're going specifically against the object model, it's only going to hit those attributes you tell it to.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Good point. Thank you.
So if I'm using a content type hub and I'm syndicating that to a site collection and consuming it there, can I use that as a parent to a local content type, and what would be the implications there? Does that start to bridge the gap of being able to have some
Now, when you say a local content type parent, so if you change that source content type in the content type hub and republish it, then it will overwrite the root one.
Yes.
Right? So
but
you can do that and then inherit from that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
As long as you're careful and aren't changing the existing columns downstream, because they'll get overwritten.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. So if it's
What's
other
that?
Columns that are changed, that would give us that ability.
Yeah. So there's you're basically doing another layer of, like, you'd only do that unless if you needed cross-site collection.
Yeah.
Like if you didn't, you know, you'd just do it in the site collection. But yeah, if you want cross-site collection, you could do that.
Yep. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
I'm creating a site definition that uses a particular content type that I was planning on doing through the content type syndication hub. But it's my understanding, in order for those content types to show up, that timer service has to run.
Yes.
And is that correct? On a new site collection creation, that content type will not exist until that timer job runs.
Right. Correct.
Yeah. You can change it. I think by default, it runs like once every hour. For my testing, I tweaked it to be like every 15 minutes. So you can change the interval for how often that runs.
But if I'm making, if I'm doing feature stapling on a site definition,
you're out of luck.
I'm out of luck.
Yeah, you, if you want, you want accessibility, that's a really good point. I'm glad you brought it up. If you want accessibility to that syndicated content type right away at site creation, it's not going to be there because the timer job has to finish first.
Right. So I should probably use the Visual Studio content type creation on my own features.
And then just create it yourself. Yeah.
And now, well, if I do it that way, am I able to define my own GUID for that content type? So all my site collections essentially will have the same GUID for that, that content type?
No, they'll be different.
They'll be different.
Each site collection will be different.
So that's but when you do it with the content the hub, are they different there as well, or are they the same?
You know, I don't know offhand.
I don't know. I mean, my assumption, it could be wrong, was that they'd be different because they're copies.
Right.
So yeah, I think
I'm basically simulating.
It's basically almost doing the same thing you're doing, except you have more control over it.
Right. Okay. Sounds good. Thanks, guys.
Yep. Thank you.
With the reporting tool, the example you gave where there was like 44 documents listed, do you also look at the recycle bin?
I'm sorry?
Do you look at the recycle bin?
Does it look at the recycle bin?
Yeah, because when you delete a site content type,
yeah,
you'll get the error message if there's an item that's in a recycle
bin. I don't know. I honestly didn't look at to see if it pulls that up because I didn't have any in my local example. I don't know if that list is kind of hidden from the report.
If not, you're welcome to add that and then republish it out to everybody in the room. How's that?
Yeah.
Do I get applause?
Hey,
of course.
All right.
Of course.
Hi, great session. We have a customer who has a dedicated form with the Content Type Hub in the consumer web app and all that, and we want to move towards a dedicated enterprise form. So the question's about migration of the Content Type Hub. I know there's gotchas, but what pointers do you have?
If you upgrade, so is it all in...
Currently, it's one farm. We're moving to two farms.
It's one farm, and you're splitting it into two farms.
Correct. Services versus...
Are you moving half the content into one farm and half into the other?
No, there's a services, dedicated services farm only.
Oh, a dedicated services farm.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Oh, then you'll be fine.
So how do I migrate the content type hub? Is there issues with that?
Yeah. When you upgrade the managed metadata service database, it'll create a new one. Are you going from 2010 to 2013?
Correct.
Yeah. You can upgrade the managed metadata service, and it'll move that for you.
Yeah, take the database over, and you can upgrade the service database.
So no URL change, nothing? All right,
thank you. It should keep it all the same, yeah.
All right, we'll cross our fingers.
Yep.
Thanks.
Test first, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Don't call us if it doesn't.
Yeah, yeah.
Great session.
Your mileage
guys.
May vary. No, it should work.
I have a problem with my dev and QA environment, not so much as in the production, because a lot of business requirements changes. Sometimes they're like, I want to name this column something else, and I have pretty similar environments in dev QA and production. How do I manage those changes? Because sometimes it screws up in my dev and QA environment. Is there any best practice to manage those column name changes or additions and deletions in Content Type Hub?
Well, what we were saying is in the dev environment, you would have some sort of publishing process where you'd create it, you'd test it, and then you'd publish it. And then once it was published, then it would get consumed and propagated out. So we see kind of like a dev, test, publish, approve, and then ship it out.
But sometimes when you change the name, the column display name, some columns would propagate properly in Dev and QA because there's a lot of changes going on.
Yep.
Some won't. So it becomes really messy to go into every site collection and see which one pushed down.
The columns are actually propagating, but because they might match a name of something else, there might be a collision, and that's where it breaks.
Is there a way to have it catch the errors or the logs in one place?
I would actually recommend creating brand new columns and brand new content types and then publishing those.
Okay.
Instead of just tweaking them, like, because you're in dev or test or whatever, so you have the luxury of recreating it. Yeah, and the cleanest way to do that is through code, actually. I know that's not ideal, but if you don't want to use code, just recreate the content type in the columns,
cool.
And it'll create all brand new GUIDs and everything.
Thank you.
Quick question. Thank you for this session. The question is, Content Type Syndication Hub, actually, there are two timer jobs which actually pushes all the columns from two different site collections.
Yes.
Now, my question is there any best practice or guideline like on setting the times on those timer jobs,
how often they run?
Yeah, how often they run.
It depends how often you need to update content types. I mean, really, the big issue there is, are you creating sites often that rely on content types?
Correct.
And if you are, what's the expectation of users after they create a site? of when they can start using content types.
Okay. So,
so if it's the default of every hour or so, you could run into a situation where you create a site and there, the content types won't be there for an hour.
Great, great. Okay, so from technology point, it's okay to set up whatever
Yeah,
it is.
I mean, the answer is a really bad consulting answer, which is it depends. But here's what it depends on, which is pretty much every timer job in SharePoint, you want to run it as infrequently as possible as you can get away with, but still providing as much real-time results to users as possible, right?
Yep.
So the balance is don't run it every minute because you're just going to hammer your system for no reason because it has to go scan and see what can be updated or needs to be updated.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, if you only create one site a week or something and the users don't even create them themselves, you create them, you know. Here's what you can do, actually. Is let's say IT is in charge of site collection creation, but users can create their own subsites. What you have is a situation where you can actually have the subsites inherit from a content type in the site collection route.
Right.
But that could be a subscriber. So if IT is creating the site collections, they can wait an hour before they send the link to the user, let's say.
Right.
But then every subsite will have the site content types immediately because they're actually inheriting from the local site collection.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's probably your best. That's probably your best approach.
Yeah, yeah. That's great.
So unfortunately, we're getting the hook. So if you want to come up to the side, we're gonna disconnect. Let the next guy come up. If you want to come up to the side here, we'll take some more.